I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is in Columbus, Ohio today, where his stimulus package is saving the jobs of 25 city police recruits who graduate today and will now not get pink slips along with their diplomas.
This city of Columbus needs the courage and the commitment of this graduating class to keep it safe, to make sure that people have the protection that they need. This economy needs your employment to keep it running.
So, 25 jobs saved in Ohio, but 651,000 lost nationwide, the worst payroll drop since 1949. By now, you've heard the new figures from the Labor Department. Unemployment topping 8%, the highest rate in 25 years. Nariman Baravesh is chief economist for Global Insight. He joins us. And Nariman, I heard an analyst this morning say, well, remember, this is when entrepreneurs flourish. You know, Toll House cookies were invented during the Depression. But do you see any light at the end of this tunnel that isn't a train barreling down on us?
I think there is a light at the end of the tunnel, but unfortunately, between here and there, things are likely to get worse. And the light at the end of the tunnel, I think, is all the stuff that the Federal Reserve has done in terms of lowering interest rates, the big Obama fiscal package. That will stabilize the economy and the jobs market, but not until the second half of the year.
And when you say second half of the year, what do you mean? What's the dividing line?
Sometime over the summer, I think we'll start to see this starting to ease off, these big numbers shrinking in terms of the job losses. They may continue to be some job losses, but much smaller than we're seeing on these monthly numbers. But between now and then, we could see another 3 or 4 months of 500, 600, possibly even 700,000 sort of job loss months, because it will take a while for all this stimulus to kick in and have an effect on the economy.
Well, you know, 25 city police recruits in Columbus, if you multiply that across the country, that could add up. And a lot of the stimulus money is going to road construction and repair. But as we take apart today's numbers, construction companies eliminated more than 100,000 jobs in February. That's a lot of people to put back to work.
That's right. The problem is that the stimulus, which is big, no question about it, isn't really going to kick in for a few more months. And really, the biggest impacts are going to be at the end of this year and actually in 2010. So that's one of the problems with the stimulus. My criticism would be it wasn't front-loaded enough in the sense of having a big impact in 2009.
Front-loaded with what?
Well, front-loaded with spending that will really kick in this year, or front-loaded with tax cuts that were somehow or other tied to spending on homes or cars or whatever. From that perspective, we're just not going to see it for a while.
Well, the other jobs that were shed this time around, white-collar business jobs, manufacturing jobs. But here in Massachusetts, maybe another light at the end of the tunnel. Companies involved in renewable energy are already hiring new workers to take advantage of the green energy money in the stimulus bill. The Boston Globe is reporting that Boston Power added 20 to 25 workers, Evergreen Solar and Aeronautica Wind Power hiring up to 100 people. We're actually doing a story in the coming days about a community college in California that's training construction workers to go into these green energy jobs. You see some silver lining there?
Oh, very much so. And I think there are 3 or 4 areas I would identify that are going to benefit from the stimulus plan in particular. You mentioned the green energy and the renewable energy area. Healthcare, obviously another one. Education is a third. And then construction. You mentioned that construction jobs had fallen. Indeed, they have. But I would expect once these infrastructure projects get going, then we'll start to see construction beginning to turn around as well.
Right. And Nariman, when it comes to job loss, I heard another analyst today say, we used to think of Michigan as an outlier, you know, losing all those auto industry jobs. That was just specific to Michigan. Now some analysts are saying maybe it's not. Maybe it's a bellwether. What do you think? Are we all going to see in our states a version of Pontiac, the really troubled town in Michigan?
We need to be sure to separate out structural issues and cyclical issues. Certainly Michigan and those areas that are affected most by the autos industry have been suffering a long-term decline because of the structural problems in the autos industry. However, many other parts of the country are being affected more by the business cycle, so down and then back up again. And it's not going to be a sort of a repeat of Pontiac or some of the other cities in Michigan, which have these more long-term problems.
Well, one last question for you, Nariman. Paul Krugman writes today that the Obama administration is waiting too long to take over banks because of fear of the word nationalization. And Doris Kearns Goodwin said pretty much the same thing this morning on the IMUS program. She said that fear is unfounded. In FDR's time, people said the same thing. Oh, this is socialism. And we, the U.S., went immediately back to a market economy as soon as the economy righted itself. Do you also agree that the Obama administration is waiting too long to take over banks?
I think they are waiting too long in terms of fixing the banking system. And I would favor taking over the hardest hit banks, nationalizing them, splitting them into what's been called good banks and bad banks, reprivatizing the good banks, if you will, and then the government hangs on to those bad assets and disposes of them slowly. I think that's the formula for getting us out of this, and the sooner they do it, the better.
Nariman Berevish, Chief Economist for Global Insight. Nariman, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, on Fridays, we like to take a break from the headline news and explore a story off the radar, or in today's case, up on the Jumbotron. Who needs a big Jumbotron leprechaun waving a picket fence, get it, to tell you to yell defense? Well, apparently a lot of new NBA fans.
Everybody clap your hands.
This was last Sunday's game here in Boston at the TD Bank North Garden between the Celtics and the Detroit Pistons. Before it was over, there were roughly 125 songs played, 100 crowd shots, and 45 replays on the giant TV screen called the Jumbotron that hangs over the court. 40 T-shirts shot into the crowd by air guns, 4 on-court promotions, 3 dance routines, and a halftime performance by a young man playing drums on plastic containers. Well, at least they brought the poor guy inside. Usually he's outside the garden. The night I went to a game, there was also a lovely woman 15 feet above the ground on a unicycle who stunned the crowd as she balanced more and more bowls on her head. It was amazing. But what did it have to do with basketball? That's the question reporter Shira Springer sets out to answer in a special feature for the Boston Globe. And Shira joins us in the studio with sort of a preview. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We should say that we actually sat next to each other at a Celtics game in which we marveled at what was going on around us. And a lot of people around us started joining in. First of all, is it the same across the country and across professional sports now? Is everybody doing these game presentations?
The flavor is a little bit different market to market. You have more of a South Beach Miami club vibe at Miami Heat games, and you might have some different features at a Lakers game. But every sport, every city is doing game presentation.
Well, in fact, in Los Angeles at a Lakers game, if the Lakers can keep the opponent's score below 100, everyone gets tacos. And let's listen to how the crowd reacts to that.
We want tacos! We want tacos! We want tacos!
How about, we want a good game. We want to see some good play. All right, Shira, you write that game presentation has become the bread and butter of sports franchises. They're trying to build fan loyalty. But, you know, what's the result? What does it feel like in there?
Well, I think it depends what demographic you fall into. If you are an old-timer, so to speak, or somebody who's a purist when it comes to your sports consumption.
Let's use the word purist.
If you're a purist when it comes to your sports consumption, then you're a bit annoyed and you find it distracting and it takes away from the experience that you want to have. If you are of the TiVo, Twitter, Facebook, MySpace generation, then you love it. You're accustomed to seeing cluttered television screens. You want constant action and you want constant noise.
Well, describe more what it's like for those who haven't been to a game lately, because you don't really get this when you watch it on television. And you describe it as an over-caffeinated combination of World Wrestling, Disney, and Vegas. Tell us a little more about what it feels like in there.
Well, again, depending on your perspective, it's either an assault or a sensory jolt. But from the moment you walk into an arena like the TD Bank North Garden, you have sounds coming. There are pictures up on the Jumbotron. And then once the game starts, almost every stoppage in play is filled with something. It could be a promotion. It could be a player on the Jumbotron doing a karaoke contest. It could be a trivia question put up on the Jumbotron. You could have a cheerleader shooting T-shirts into the stands. There is always something going on. There is no break in the action. And as you and I found out, there's no quiet time to even have a conversation about the game. And I know in talking to people who knew Celtics patriarch Red Auerbach, that was his real big complaint. He wanted to talk about the game when he was at the game, and he couldn't.
Well, and this gives us a sense of how things have changed, because people across the country might have had the same experience just a couple decades ago. At the Boston Garden, there might be an organist, John Kiley, who might occasionally play to get people clapping. But Red Auerbach, again, the general manager of the Boston Celtics, legendary guy, wouldn't let him play during play.
The game time was sacred time for him and for fans at that point. And I think for some fans it still is, but franchises cannot risk having silence because they worry about losing that younger demographic.
Well, go from then to today, when current Celtics owner Wick Grosbeck credits the game presentation, all of this stuff, with actually laying the financial foundation for the Celtics' 2008 NBA title run. How so?
Well, first of all, I think he's right, and he's right because during the lean years when the Celtics were at the very bottom of the league, they had to get fans to come in. They had to get fans excited about the Celtics. And let's be honest, it wasn't the players and it wasn't the play that was doing that. And as a result, they used, they don't like the word gimmicks, but in some sense they are gimmicks. They used giveaways. They used game presentation to draw fans in and get people paying for tickets. And that revenue helps, you know, translates to players getting extensions, et cetera, et cetera.
Players getting paid.
Exactly.
The big salaries they're getting paid. But also, don't teams today across the board, to bring in new generations, they're competing with the kids' video games at home and HDTV.
All the technology that's out there, they have to compete with. They have to offer something that you can't get sitting on your couch at home. And that is a very difficult task. And it's multiplied or made more difficult by the fact that not only are you trying to please one person and attract them and get them off the couch, you got to try to get 18,000 people to fill the Garden, or you got to get 80,000 people to fill Gillette Stadium.
In Foxborough, which is where the Patriots play, and of course this is repeated across the country. Well, here in Boston, which you study in detail, the Celtics and the Boston Bruins hockey team, also plays at the same building, invested $3.5 million in all this high-definition stuff to get people to come in and not watch at home. But to me, the weird thing is they're not watching the game on the floor when they come. If you look around an arena, you can even see it in some of the camera shots when you look in other cities. People are looking up. They're looking at the Jumbotron. They're there. They paid a lot of money to be there, but they're still watching TV.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had this conversation or similar conversation with NBA Commissioner David Stern, and he said, yes. He goes, even I sometimes catch myself watching the game on the high-definition Jumbotron instead of watching it on the court. He said, you know, I can only imagine what's going to happen when fans start getting statistics on their cell phones and getting replays on their cell phones. So there's, you know, then we're really getting into the territory potentially of sensory overload.
That's Shira Springer of the Boston Globe. Her series on game presentation starts this Sunday, and she writes about how those images get up on the Jumbotron here in Boston, a control room with 41 HD monitors, directors directing crowd shots, noise prompts, working off a 75-page script. When we come back, Shira's going to give us a sneak peek at the new high-tech Yankee Stadium in New York. Talk about getting replays on your phone, whether you hear. And later today, we're going to check in with some of you, our listeners, including a trucker on the road in Texas. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back.
Here comes your Celtics Green Team with free T-shirts.
Incoming rolled-up T-shirt shot from air cannons into the crowd at the TD Bank North Garden during a fourth-quarter break in last Sunday's Boston Celtics game. It's all part of the show. That's standard fare at many sports events these days. Shira Springer is reporting on game presentation for the Boston Globe. And, Shira, you say we're going to get a look at the future of game presentation next month when the New York Yankees have their home opener in their new state-of-the-art stadium. And we hear the buzzword there is telepresence.
Yeah, telepresence, stadium vision, those are all the high-tech buzzwords put out there by Cisco Systems, which is the company that has wired Yankee Stadium. But basically, it's a $1.3 billion stadium with, they estimate, 15 to 16 million invested in technology. That means you're going to have somewhere around 1,400 HD monitors all around the stadium, restaurants, restrooms, luxury suites, And with these monitors, you can custom program them. They can give you real-time traffic updates, or they can give you real-time statistical updates. They can replay the game. You are also going to have a immense main scoreboard in HD, 59 feet high, 104 feet wide. You are going to have telepresence, potentially, which is where you can video conference. It's the latest technology in video conferencing. You can video conference potentially with players before or after games. And now it sounds, okay, well, we've all done video conferencing, but it's done in HD, and it's done in such a way, and I've done it, that you feel like you are actually sitting next to the player. I've telepresenced with Magic Johnson, and I swear to God, even if though he was in L.A., I thought he was across the table from me in Boston.
And you have been across the table from Magic Johnson.
And so it was just the same.
Exactly the same. Wow.
They also have the capacity to allow fans to get replays on their cell phones. There is the potential for fans to be sitting in their seats and using their cell phones to order concessions, see replays, check up on their fantasy teams, chat with friends outside their stadiums, take cell phone video, and then put it up on some web message board or website all before they leave the stadium.
Is part of this that this is a Pandora's box, that everything new gets old again? So, okay, so we're clapping and we're singing, and that's not enough. Now that sports teams have committed to this, they have to keep up.
Yes, it is a bit of a Pandora's box. And I think on the technology side, teams are very concerned. I've talked to a number of top league and team executives, including Lon Trost, who's the COO of the Yankees, and they're going to be very restrained in how they implement technology at Yankee Stadium. You won't see everything the stadium can do on opening day. They're going to hold back because, as Lon Trost said, we want fans to know the building, learn the building before they start playing around.
Before they start playing the building.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing.
Exactly.
In the building. Well, and they're playing now, as we said, in arenas across the country. Let's go back to Boston, the Jumbotron, which is this huge, you know, it's like a five-screen video thing, so it's a surround video.
Yeah, I was going to say they prefer that it be called the HDX because it's high-definition extreme.
Pardon me. So the Jumbotron is hanging down, the HDX thing. And one of the things you notice first, if you haven't been to a game in a while, is how many kids, adults too, but how many kids are trying to get on the Jumbotron, because part of it is dancing. You're dancing and you're trying to get your image up there. One high schooler, Jeremy Fry, is now a sensation because the Jumbotron caught him dancing to Jon Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer. It went viral on YouTube. We'll have this for you at our website, hereandnow.org. You have to see it. But we also spoke at a game with 7-year-old Daylin Troutman. His dancing is often featured on the Jumbotron, and they've become regulars. And we asked him and his mom, Dana, to imagine a game without it.
I would feel like getting out of here.
No, that's it. You'd still be able to watch the game and
I
stuff.
I would feel like watching the game, but I would kind of feel, 50-50, happy, not happy.
Oh, without the Jumbotron?
Yeah. That makes people be happy.
Yeah.
He has a point. The kids in particular, I mean, as far as this little kid's concerned, this game's about him. He sees himself up there, that image of him. It's 50-50 between him and the team.
And you know what? The team likes that. And the team encourages that. I talked with the producer of game presentation at the Garden, and they really want to get the fans involved. Crowd shots are their money shots.
Well, and do they have research that backs them up, that they're not making a mistake and turning off purists, that the benefit outweighs whatever loss they might have?
They say they do. I mean, I will give the NBA and the NHL and all these professional leagues credit. They are practically nonstop surveyors. They are constantly seeking fan feedback. And the fan feedback they're getting tells them that fans want this, at least the majority of fans want this. And they term those who don't like it as the vocal minority.
Yeah. In fact, I think one of the numbers that you had was 70% of those surveyed say they'd come back because of the game presentation.
Correct.
And Shira, by the way, one last question. You told me you went to Harvard. You studied anthropology?
Well, I studied.
And you still are.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there was some anthropology there. Yeah, social and political theory and philosophy.
Well, what do you see in this growth of, you know, from a guy who might be allowed to play the Mexican hat dance on the organ to what we see today in just a few decades? What does this tell you?
Well, first of all, it says that sports more now than ever is about the entertainment factor, and it seems always will be about the entertainment factor. Athletes are in the business of entertaining. Teams, franchise executives are in the business of entertaining, and it's going to increase, only increase with technology. I fear that more and more the game will be overshadowed, and that's a real tragedy for people who enjoy sports and enjoy the purest element.
Shira Springer covers the world of sports for the Boston Globe. Her two-part series on the state of game presentation in Major League Sports begins in Sunday's edition. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. And while there, tell us what, you know, your team does in your city. Shira, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And next week on Here and Now, remember the very pregnant rapper M.I.A. singing at the Grammys? She's Tamil and introduced many young Americans to her home of Sri Lanka, but we'll meet a young Tamil American who wishes more knew about the troubles in Sri Lanka. Still ahead today, what New Deal photographer Dorothea Lang can teach us today after the news. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we have a follow-up. Earlier this week, we spoke with Philip Longman, a train enthusiast who made the case to move much of America's freight off the roads and onto rails to relieve congestion, be better for the environment, and drivers. But what about truck drivers? What would happen to them? Carrie Evans Spillman of the industry magazine Landline wrote us to ask, would you like to travel 50 miles from your home to visit a train depot to get your groceries or fuel? Because that is exactly what most of us would be doing if we didn't have trucks to bring food, medicine, and other daily life essentials into our towns. And Annetta Stanley, wife of a trucker and a trucker herself, while a little offended at the implication that trucks weren't safe, said this.
When it comes to the gist of the piece, I must agree that the model of today's transport by 18-wheelers is economically and environmentally ruinous. I know that many in this industry would disagree, but the truth is the efficiency of the current system is obvious in every traffic jam, in the deterioration of the interstate bridges and roads, and in the statistics cited by the author about the amount of energy used per mile, the 280 trucks equal to one train.
And then Annetta also added,
for those who would say, what about all those truckers who would be out of a job, remember that this plan would only reduce the long-haul trucks. There would be more jobs for those short hauls from rail depot to destination.
Well, and that's a point our guest, Philip Longman, also made in his essay in Washington Monthly magazine, but one which we didn't get to in our piece. Here are Phil's thoughts.
The system basically requires that at factory gate, a truck rolls up, its container is loaded up, it drives to the nearest railhead, and on the other end of its journey, another truck takes that container off the flat car and drives it to wherever it's going. So there's a tremendous amount of jobs, potentially more even than we have today, for truckers, but they can sleep in their own beds.
Well, I hope that satisfies trucker Jeff Clark, who also wrote us. He joins us on the line now. Jeff, do you buy into this idea that truckers won't lose as many jobs because you'll still be needed to put the freight on the trains and take it places where trains can't go?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'd have to see how it works out. You know, either way, I'll adapt. Believe me, I'd rather sleep in my bed than in my bunk.
Well, I want to mention one other thing that you also objected to in your email. I used the phrase scary trucks, and you were offended by that.
Yeah, I was. I've been driving 21 years, never had a moving violation. I'm out here trying to do my job, and we have a bad reputation.
And I'm sorry if I added to it, but as you're well aware, you know, there are, some horrendous accidents. And, Jeff, ironies abound. You're standing near a train, aren't you?
Yes.
Well, we'll let it go by. But, you know, there are people who are afraid of trucks. Just tell us quickly, what are some things that we should do when driving with trucks?
Well, when you pass a truck, get on by. Don't tailgate trucks. if you pass us, don't slow down right after you pass us either. And give us room when you pass us.
Well, back to some of the concerns about trucks. Statistics do show that truckers are among the safest drivers on the road. But a study in 2007 found truck drivers having seizures or otherwise being physically impaired were the leading cause of large truck crashes. Now, that included healthy drivers who'd fallen asleep. But you do say truck drivers do need to shape up. You've got a book out titled, Hey, We're Dying Out Here, The Truth Behind the Trucker Shortage. Statistics show that truckers die about 15 years younger than the average American. And you have this new 14:10 rule. What is that?
What it is when we start our workday, we have to stop at 14 hours. We have to wait 10 hours again before we can go to work.
14 hours is still a long time to be, at work, but it, at least you don't go over that.
Yes, and we can only drive 11 of those 14.
And I know you have a lot of complaints about how truckers have to stand around and wait for people to offload trucks. They, you know, a lot of their time is wasted because you feel truckers need to have time to do things like work out, take care of themselves.
Right. I'm a runner, and I run during my 10-hour break. But what happens is we might have a load that's supposed to be ready at 8 o'clock. And we get there at 8 o'clock and the load's not ready. The load's not ready till midnight. And we've lost 4 hours of potential earning. And we need every hour we can get because we are struggling. And there's no punishment for the shipper who didn't have the load ready.
So you think there should be some sort of additional expense if a load isn't ready, and that would hurry everybody up. And in turn, that would keep truckers from standing around. And you mentioned you're a long-distance runner. You took that up because you're a trucker and you knew you needed to do something about your health.
Yeah, I've got a family history of heart disease. I struggle with high blood pressure. In 1988, when I started driving the truck, I failed my physical for high blood pressure.
But what do you think about the reports that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, which is the regulatory agency that oversees truckers, hasn't followed through on any of the recommendations that regulators proposed in 2001 that would keep truckers from doing things that they now do, shopping around for doctors who say they are healthy enough to drive?
Oh, it angers me. It angers me. I know in my book I proposed to eliminate doctor shopping. If the driver does fail the physical, there's absolutely nothing stopping him from going to another doctor.
Right.
Until he finds a doctor that's going to pass him.
So Jeff Clark, an independent trucker, by the way, who lives in Wisconsin, he's joining us today from Houston as he does his drive. You think that some of the regulation of truckers has to be tightened up a little bit, but also that truckers have to step up and take care of themselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When you start your driving career, they should tell you that this is going to take 15 years off of your life on average. And, you know, you wonder how many guys would say, wait a minute, I'm not going to drive a truck. You know, we also need help. Fair labor laws were enacted in 1938, basically. And there was no interstate truckers, very few. And the laws should apply to us, and they don't.
Jeff Clark, thanks so much. We'll let you get back to your work of moving goods around the country. And thanks so much for listening to us and taking the time to write.
Thank you, Rabbit.
Well, we have a minute to hear from a few more of you, so let's do that. Music writer Mark Hirsch was here this week. He discovered that you can sing What If God Was One of Us over many other pop songs because they share what he called the sensitive female chord progression that guys sing too. Bridget Madden writes, I call it the romantic comedy montage. You know, the films in which girl gets over the bad guy and is about ready to go for the good guy. She purges her apartment of reminders of bad guy, major one chord. She jogs around the park, minor six chord. She gets a new haircut, better wardrobe, lovable pet, major five chord, etc. And Darlene Messina of Philadelphia said, I've been unemployed now for 10 months, working all day long in my house, shopping for a job on the computer. Thank you for this story. Dave Moffat wasn't so happy. He writes, how can a serious music journalist call anything the sensitive female chord progression? Rock and roll was built on the 1-4-5 progression. The blues is 1-7-4-7-5-7. But sensitive female chord progression? Please, I'm going to go bang on my guitar using the angry male listener chord progression. Well, sorry to offend Dave, but Mark's technical name was actually the sensitive female chord progression guys play too. And since Darlene's out of work and this makes her smile, we're playing it again. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at letters@hereandnow.org or call us 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. 'Cause they stick up for me.
God is one of us. It's too high for me. Just a slob like one of us.
Let's try again. We'll find our key.
Okay, let's listen. Let's listen. We can do this.
If God is one of us.
Just a slob like one of us.
Everybody.
A mystery.
Okay, enough of that. Across the decades, an old black and white photo still speaks to us, perhaps even more these days. You remember it, a mother in an old kitchen dress and tattered sweater, two children huddled against her back, a baby in the crook of her listless arm, a worried hand at her cheek, the Dust Bowl landscape mirrored in her lined face. Migrant Mother, which you can see at our website, herenow.org, was taken by Dorothea Lange, who captioned it Destitute Pea Picker in California, a 32-year-old mother of seven children, February 1936. Lange was one of several photographers hired under FDR's New Deal to document the plight of migrant workers and report back on how well New Deal programs were working. Her work was journalism, but it became art, even icon. The photo Migrant Mother was featured on a postage stamp. Well, MIT professor Anne Whiston Spern says the captions Lange wrote to accompany her photos are just as important as the photos themselves. Professor Spern traveled back to places Lange went to see what they're like now, and she gathers all of this in her new book, Daring to Look, Dorothea Lange's Photographs and Reports from the Field, and joins us in the studio with more. Anne, welcome.
Thank you.
This is just a wonderful read. It's a visual delight, even though some of the images are tough to look at. Put Dorothea Lange in context for us. Friends with Ansel Adams, praised by Eleanor Roosevelt. Steinbeck may have been influenced by her. Who was she?
She was a photographer of the wealthy, a portrait photographer. And in 1933, at the beginning of FDR's first administration, she looked down into the street at the homeless and the unemployed and decided to take her camera down into the street.
You quote her, she, in writing about that later, she said to herself, make this happen. In fact, you took the title of your book from something she said. Tell us about that.
Yes. She said, no country has ever closely scrutinized itself visually that I know of. I know what we could make of it if people only thought we could dare look at ourselves.
Hmm. She had to do something.
Exactly. Within 3 years, she'd taken Migrant Mother and was working for the federal government in the Resettlement Administration. And she was sent out by the government to record the conditions that the government programs were, new government programs were set up to address. But she also, even after those programs kicked in and she was supposed to be looking for successes, she said, I found things that weren't working. And she asked people about their stories. She took down details about how they were doing, what their hopes and dreams were, where they'd come from, how they'd gotten to be at that point in time when she met them.
Here are some of the captions for her pictures. There is the interior of the Evanson one-room cabin, and you see these beautiful potted plants in the window, and Mrs. Evanson brought the plants with her from Montana, the note reads. Homeless family of seven walking the highway from Phoenix, Arizona, where they picked cotton, bound for San Diego, where the father hopes to get on the relief because, quote, he once lived there. But I don't mean to imply that this isn't true hardship, but this, you know, led us to one of the questions we wanted to ask you. Most of the women are in pretty, but even if worn, but pretty cotton kitchen dresses. The little girls all have dresses on. They all have Sunday hats on. Is there something that gets romanticized in a Dorothea Lange picture, or is that something that you write she also was determined to do, which is give them their dignity?
Exactly. She doesn't portray them as pitiful. She portrays them as people with pride and with hopes and dreams, not just in a pitiable state.
What was the impact of the photographs? We know that when she first took the pictures to Washington, she pretty much changed the way lawmakers researched the Depression. But then she and her second husband, Berkeley social scientist Paul Taylor, worked together. And you write that if he's the father of the migratory camp program in California, she's the mother. Why? What did they bring about?
Well, together he was given the job of checking out on the situation of agricultural workers in California. So Lange went out with him and began taking these photographs. This was just after, a few months after she'd gone down into the streets of San Francisco. And they made a case for the government to build camps for the migrant workers to to live in, to improve their conditions, and were apparently responsible for some of the first government labor camps in California.
MIT professor Ann Whiston Spurn, whose book is called Daring to Look, Dorothea Lange's Photographs and Reports from the Field. Dorothea Lange was hired under FDR's New Deal. She took hundreds of pictures of migrant workers in California, North Carolina, and the Pacific Northwest, and wrote about the people and places she found in detailed and often poignant captions. Professor Spurn has gone back and photographed some of the places Lange visited. Her pictures say a lot about where we are today. And Ann, Professor, you remind us, landscape photographer Ansel Adams didn't get what Lange was doing. He asked, why is Dorothea photographing all those dirty people? But Lange was capturing something more. For instance, she documented the first wave of Dust Bowl migrants coming from the middle of the country into California's Imperial Valley to pick vegetables. And you recently returned from a trip to the same field. Walk us through the photos then and now. You have them side by side. You know, what she took, what you saw.
Well, she was taking many photographs in the Imperial Valley, which is right along the border of Mexico between Arizona and San Diego. And the conditions that she found there were really horrendous. People living, a family of 11 living in one tent, for example, with their 9 children. Workers lining up at 5 a.m. in the fields to pick, in order to hold a place to pick, even though the picking of carrots didn't start until 8 o'clock. They had to line up at 5 in the morning. What I discovered when I was in the Imperial Valley was that today 85% to 90% of the agricultural workers cutting our lettuce and our cauliflower and our broccoli are Mexicans, and that they are not migrant workers, except in the sense that they cross the border every day. They live in Mexico. In this case, they don't just get in the field by 5 to hold a place in line for picking that starts at 8. Picking starts at 7. But in many cases, they're getting up at 1 in the morning in order to cross the border in time to sign on with the foreman by 4 in the morning.
Are they coming in legally?
They're coming in legally. They have green cards. They get paid minimum wage. They are put into buses trailing porta-potties behind the bus, and they travel up to as much as 2 hours, both to and from the fields.
We know they exist. We see photos. But it sounds like what's different is, these aren't displaced Americans wandering the landscape.
No, many people told me, well, Americans won't take these jobs.
Yeah.
And that's why the Mexicans have them.
Well, you also track down people who were in the pictures, maybe not the people themselves, but their descendants. And you find yourself wondering when you look at these pictures, what happened to them? Where are their descendants? You track down the Wardlaw family. First of all, tell us about the family then and who you found today.
Well, the Wardlaw family came from Arkansas. They left Arkansas on July 20th, 1936 for southeastern Oregon. And one of their older sons had been working on the construction of the Owyhee Reservoir and canal system that was intended to irrigate sagebrush desert and create new farmsteads for displaced refugees from the Dust Bowl. So they were 40 to 80 acre homesteads, and the Wardlaws took off for one of these homesteads, and they were one of the first families to settle when the sagebrush desert was opened up for farmers to settle it. They lived in a one-bedroom dugout home with their son, Glenn, who at the time was 9 years old. Lange met up with the family after church services. She took a photograph of the basement dugout church, and Mrs. Wardlaw invited her for Sunday dinner. She came and took many photographs of Glenn, the 9-year-old Glenn, sitting at the kitchen table, and she took this wonderful photograph of Mr. and Mrs. Wardlaw at the doorway to their basement dugout home, which is in my book. Mrs. Wardlaw is holding a book in her arm, and there are water cans and milk cans outside in the yard. I was able to find the Wardlaw's son, Glenn, today, living in Nampa, Idaho, and when I showed him this photograph, he'd never seen many of these photographs of his parents. He just was astonished, first of all, to see them. He remembered Lange's visit. And he then proceeded to tell me what it was like to to clear the sagebrush desert and get fields established. He said the dust was like flour. You'd plow it, and if you stepped in it, you'd sink down as deep as you'd plowed. Everything that was in all the photographs, he told me that the book his mother was holding was her mother's cookbook. It was the thing that she valued most that she brought with her from Arkansas. And it later burned up in a fire.
Mm. And why were they farming in desert? Because that's what a lot of the pictures are, clearing stumps, trying to make the land submit.
Drought had really forced them out, and they were attracted to, in the case of the Wardlaw family, to eastern Oregon because of this new irrigation project that had been developed by the government. One of the major government programs to get people back to work was the building of dams and irrigation canals to bring water to desert land that could then be turned into farmland and where one wouldn't have to worry about drought because one could order up the water when one needed it for the crops rather than look at the sky for rain.
Well, it looks so incredibly hard trying to tame the land. But some of the older farmers you met when you traveled more recently told you they felt they were better off in 1939. How's that possible?
Yes, Ralph Kamek said to me, and Ralph wasn't the only one, that he said, we were all in the same boat back then, and everyone helped each other. Everyone patronized local merchants. The town of Nissa in Oregon was thriving. Lang has photographs of the stores. There was a mural that she photographed that said, patronize your home merchants.
There's the smoke shop, the Powell Service Standard Products, your drugstore, used furniture, Maxie's Confectionery and Fountain. All of them are painted, hand-painted onto this huge mural on the side of a brick building. You photographed it in 2005. What did you see when you photographed it?
I came down the street. This was my first day in eastern Oregon, and I was carrying with me the photographs that Lang had took, including this one of the mural. And as soon as I saw this wall with this faded-out mural, I just pulled over, pulled out my notebook, and there was Lang's photograph. But, of course, it's faded, number one, and number two, all the boxes are blank.
All those local businesses are painted out.
Many, many, many stores are boarded up and vacant.
What do you think, Ann Whiston Spern, we should make of all of this? It was a very different time, but we're constantly told that, you know, we're being compared today to the late 30s and the people in these photographs. So what do you make of it, having looked at them and Dorothy Lange's words about them?
Well, there's several things I make. The important thing about Lange's work is she wasn't just focusing on individual families. She was focusing on them as the human face of national policies. And, for example, these major infrastructure projects that brought water to the desert are the reason why we're seeing booming urban growth in the desert, because if the government hadn't built these dams and reservoirs to bring the water there for farmers, the growth of Las Vegas and Reno and Phoenix wouldn't be possible. And so the Obama administration might very well take a page out of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's program to send out photographers to go out and bear witness and see what's going on in some forgotten places in the country.
That's Ann Whiston Spern. She's professor of landscape architecture and planning at MIT, also author of the book Daring to Look, Dorothea Lange's Photographs and Reports from the Field. Ann Whiston Spern, thank you so much for the project.
Oh, you're most welcome, Robin. Thank you.